You're listening to Security Squad. Virtualization security, iPhone attacks, and PCI DSS deadlines. This is for October 12, 2007. Apple's iPhone.
I think the danger is real. It's definitely real, and I think it's only going to get more pervasive as more researchers look at these devices and spend some time working on them.
PCI DSS.
When I talk to individual IT professionals about their PCI DSS work, I haven't run into anybody who has said this is a disaster, it's a nightmare.
VMware.
What do we think is the most likely scenario for VMware? Do we think they're going to be a Microsoft where they have this sort of epiphany and realize, hey, we should be paying attention to security? And are they going to be an Apple where they, you know, they ignore security as long as possible, and however it goes, it goes?
They want to have VMware become sort of a platform for computing in much the same way that Windows became a platform. They want it to be the next sort of computing environment.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Security Squad, where the CERT security team talks about the latest issues. I'm Rob Westervelt, and well, it's been a while. We took a summer break, but we're back, and joining me today is CERT security site editor Eric Parizeau and executive editor Dennis Fisher and senior news writer Bill Brenner.
I guess among the bigger stories in the security world when it comes to iPhone security has been H.D. Moore's publishing the shellcode for Apple's iPhone and turning it into a pocket-sized attack platform. But I guess the real question is this attack platform really a threat to iPhone users? I mean, what's your take, Dennis? You wrote that particular story.
I think overall what HD did is not necessarily as much of a threat to iPhone users as it is just giving attackers another tool that they can use to attack other devices, whether it's just an iPhone or some other mobile device or any other Wi-Fi connected device, really, because that's the beauty of the iPhone. It's got the Wi-Fi technology inside of it, and it's got a full-on Safari browser. And what he was able to do is just get his own shellcode running on there, which if you can find an exploit on another Wi-Fi connected device, you'll be able to launch attacks using that iPhone, which I think most people thought was just sort of a nice little shiny new toy to play with, and you could, you know, check your email and surf the web on it, which is great, and it's got all kinds of pretty pictures. But you know, HD has shown that it's a serious computing device. You know, it's a full-on computer that can be used the way that other computers can be used offensively, as well as just as, you know, a productivity device.
Do you know, does it still work with the latest firmware version? No.
I haven't talked to him since that firmware dropped, but when I spoke with him beforehand, he was aware of what Apple was going to do with that firmware release, and he said he didn't think he'd have much trouble modifying the shellcode to work there, too.
Now, as an iPhone user myself, I love the device, but I don't think I'm that worried about being attacked. I mean, the only way you can really be attacked is if you keep your Wi-Fi on and in the middle of a public place and somebody can sniff it out and get on it.
Sure, but I think, you know, you as a, you know, relatively advanced user understand that, whereas maybe the general public probably doesn't. You know, just, you know, some college kid who's got his iPhone on wandering around in New York City or San Francisco or somewhere with the Wi-Fi enabled most of the time could easily get attacked. You know, someone could download their contacts, start sending email, doing whatever they feel like doing. HD showed a way that he could record voicemails, check your voicemail, use it as sort of like a little pocket recorder to record your phone conversations while you're having them. So I think the danger is real. It's maybe not as huge as some other problems we've seen, but it's definitely real, and I think it's only going to get more pervasive as more researchers look at these devices and spend some time working on them.
Think of it this way, Rob. Who really is buying the first generation of the iPhones? You know, it's the rich, the famous, the powerful, people like yourself. But, you know, let's say Paris Hilton goes out and trades in her T-Mobile Sidekick for a iPhone. and suddenly that, you know, paparazzi gets pictures of Paris on her iPhone. There are some ambitious hackers out there and say, oh, maybe I can go record Paris's phone calls, and before you know it, Paris's phone calls from the last week are on YouTube. So I think it high-profile attacks like that are really what got hackers' juices flowing.
I find it hard to believe that there are that many technically savvy folks out there that are going to take this shell code and build their own attack platform.
Well, look at H.D. Moore. I mean, why did he go out and do this ultimately? You know, he wanted to prove it could be done, but ultimately on some level I'm sure he wanted the publicity for it, and I'm sure there are a bunch of other attackers who feel the same way.
First, I don't think you need to exploit an iPhone to get all of that information off Paris Hilton. And
that's true. you could say she's an open book, huh?
Yeah, but it speaks to the larger issue that all of these smartphones are going to increasingly be used as an attack vector. The more people start, you know, using them like they would use their laptop or PC. So I think it's good that HD did what he did, because it gets people thinking early on about the fact that there are security implications.
Let's move on to PCI DSS. The first two PCI DSS deadlines came and went. Those deadlines were set by MasterCard and Visa, I believe. And September 30th was the compliance deadline for level one merchants, and those are companies that process more than 6 million credit card transactions a year. The level two companies that process credit card and debit cards have until the end of December to meet the whole group of security requirements in this standard. And those guys are processing 20,000 to 6 million credit card transactions a year. Now, Bill, you've been really covering this, at least from that perspective. Mm-hmm. What are some of the merchants saying right now? And, you know, is this really an issue for them? And do you really think that MasterCard or people really worried that MasterCard and Visa are going to be cracking down on them?
There seems to be a huge disconnect, this is my impression, between individual IT professionals that I talk to and some of the things that you see happening in the media. For example, the National Retailers Federation sending the PCI DSS Council this terse letter saying that they, you know, they want to see changes in how they are required to handle the storage of credit card data. They feel that they shouldn't have to store it at all in the first place, which was news to me, because every PCI auditor I'd ever talked to had been saying in the first place that you shouldn't be storing this kind of information, and that's one of the things that got TJX into trouble. But when I talk to individual IT professionals about their PCI DSS work, you know, and granted, I'm talking maybe five or six people out of millions, but I haven't run into anybody who has said, you know, this is a disaster, it's a nightmare, I'm not going to meet the September 30th deadline. I don't even know if we could reach the December deadline. People I've talked to have basically been telling me that, you know, some of the work that PCI requires is not all that different than a lot of the other regulatory work they've had to do over the last 4 years.
Let's talk briefly about this National Retail Association. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that it possibly has some anti-consumer overtones to it, that their whole push. And the reason why I say that is MasterCard and all these other credit card guys want businesses to store some credit card data for a certain period of time, and they require it. Mm-hmm. And they require it to protect consumers, giving them an opportunity to, in the event that you have a problem with a purchase or fraudulent purchases, they can go back and there's some sort of record of a transaction being made at a business.
In a case like TJX, where this whole thing started with guys sitting in a car outside of a couple of Marshall stores, you know, sniffing traffic over the air. I think what the National Retail Federation is saying is that those individual stores themselves should not be storing that data. it should be perhaps stored by TJX Corporate, wherever that is, Framingham, and let them store it. And they can, you know, if there needs to be some sort of dispute resolution, they can go through and validate it there at some central database. They don't need it stored, you know, in Needham, in, you know, Portland, Maine, wherever. Let it be stored in one central database that is theoretically more secured than, you know, some server sitting in a back room in a Marshall's in a strip mall that clearly doesn't have its own IT guy. You know, that makes sense to me. That kind of logic makes sense, but that's a big can of worms trying to get that done, because these retailers all have this custom software that was written, you know, hundreds of years ago. That's the way it works. It grabs those credit card numbers and it stores them locally, as well as sending them off to the central database. So I'm not sure how that gets resolved unless they set some sort of cutoff and say, okay, on January 1, 2008, no one is storing local credit card data anymore unless you can show some clear need. But it's hard to see how that's going to happen.
Let's move on to virtualization security. Dennis, you went to VMworld back in September, right?
Yep.
And among the messages there was that virtualized desktops provide better security than traditional PCs. Obviously, VMworld is really hyping virtualization. And talk a little bit about what some executives were really saying about security there, and then what some security experts are coming back with.
Yeah, so it's an interesting time right now, I think, for the virtualization market in general, because it's been a pretty niche technology for a while. It's been used a lot in data centers as a way to save money and cut heating and power costs, or excuse me, cooling and power costs. But right now, it's starting to become more mainstream. You know, VMware just had this monster IPO. You're seeing a lot of talk about desktop virtualization, where it's traditionally been a server technology. And the desktop virtualization certainly does have some potential in securing desktops, because a lot of the applications and services that users would typically have access to with, say, administrative rights, they no longer have that access in a virtualized environment. All of those applications, the whole OS, that image is hosted on another server, on a server somewhere else. So all they're seeing is just, you know, it's not a big difference for them in the computing experience, but they're not getting access to screw things up the way that they would in a traditional desktop model.
So in that case, security is better.
I think it can be. I don't think it's an absolute. It's a little bit like the, you know, Linux is more secure than Windows argument. It's all sort of relative. I think in some environments it can be a positive for security, but in others I think it can be a negative, because what you've got is a very complex technology that even now not a ton of mainstream IT generalists understand all that well. It hasn't been deployed on the desktop very widely, and the good and bad thing about it is that it's very, very simple to deploy. It can be deployed in seconds. So that makes it easy to get out there and very attractive to IT departments. But the other problem is that it creates complexity. It creates another layer of complexity in terms of compliance and security, and it's not very well understood, which can, you know, sort of cause problems in the long run.
Is there a lot of research being done on it?
Security research, not a ton. There are a few guys out there doing some research on it. You know, Nate Lawson is one. Joanna Rutkowska is another. But there's not a ton of it, because it's sort of a static thing that for a long time was sort of hidden in the mainframe or in the server room, the data center. And there was a lot of research done on it back in the 70s, but it sort of stagnated for 25 or 30 years, and now people are starting to become interested in it again, because it's a challenging problem. And if you can find a way to subvert the hypervisor, in a lot of cases you can wreak all kinds of havoc that is very difficult for traditional security products to even detect. There's no signature. It's not traditional malware, but if you can subvert the hypervisor and worm your way in there, then you're off to the races.
And virtualization software is really starting to make some inroads in the consumer market as well. VMware has consumer software available. Apple users can side by side run Windows and Mac OS together. So that may have further
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And they're also, I mean, VMware, for example, is also selling a product where you can get a virtualized desktop on a thumb drive, on a USB drive, so you can just carry it around, which is great, but not well understood, and nobody is real clear on what the security implications of that are. You know, it may become clear, you know, a year or 2 years from now that, you know, okay, sure, these things are, you know, they do sort of make the desktop more secure, but right now that's unknown. And I think that what VMware and some of the other vendors in this space really need to do, and especially VMware, because they're, I mean, by far the leader in the virtualization.
Who's right behind them? Do you have any idea?
There really isn't anybody right behind them. it's a crowd of one right now. So what they really need to do, I think, is to sort of come out and articulate a very clear security strategy and say, here's what we've got in the works for you guys coming down the road. Here's some secure configurations. You know, I know that at VMware, a couple of vendors and some industry associations were touting some security configuration guidelines for virtual machines, which are great. It's sort of akin to the guidelines that NIST has put out for years for Windows Server and Windows Desktop and Linux and things like that, saying, okay, here's a step-by-step guide to how you configure a VMware desktop securely or any generic virtual machine securely, which is great. I think that's a good first step. But I think VMware, sort of as the leader of the space, has a responsibility to their customers and their partners as well to come out and say, here's where we stand on security. Here's how we're going to address vulnerabilities. Here's how we're going to address this. Kind of the position that Microsoft was in 6 or 7 years ago.
Was there any of that at VMworld?
I would say it was approaching zero. The CEO had a Q&A session with reporters. A couple of security questions came up that she sort of talked around and said, you know, we made this acquisition of Determina, which is a, you know, very well thought of security technology, but we're not really ready to disclose any plans yet, which is, I mean, understandable, but at some point you need to sort of get out there and get the message out there and not leave the 12,000 people that attended your trade show wondering what exactly you have in the works for them.
I think it makes sense for VMware not to get out big in front of security right now, just because nobody really seems to understand the full enterprise implications of virtualization. So it seems to me like even if they jumped out right now and they tried to articulate a full detailed security strategy, would they have to change the whole strategy in 6 or 12 months? I mean, it seems to me like it's a little bit early. I mean, why not right now figure out what the implications of virtualization are going to be overall for the enterprise, and then when it's a little clearer what the security implications are, then try to figure it out. I mean, right now, beyond, you know, virtualization hardcore junkies, who really gets what virtualization is going to mean to the enterprise 12 to 24 months from now? I mean, I think there's so generally little understanding of those implications. I don't think the virtualization security risks are a significant issue right now, even for attackers. I mean, there are probably a few out there who are, you know, playing around with the technology, but by and large, if the technology is only in its infancy in the enterprise, and it's unclear how you can go about attacking it successfully and what you can get, I don't see a lot of attackers focusing their efforts on that right now. Maybe I'm wrong.
But I think that ambiguity is part of the problem, because there is so much unknown about the way that virtual machines interact with traditional desktop applications, host OSs, the way that these things interact with each other. If there's multiple virtual machines on servers, which is often the case, you know, it's been thought for years that there was no way to escape from one virtual machine and then start running code on the host OS, but that was proven false about 2 months ago. Somebody found a way to do that. And I think it's probably worth their time to even if they come out and articulate a strategy and then say, you know, listen, this is open to interpretation. It's going to change over time. It's a dynamic marketplace. It's a dynamic technology. We're going to have to sort of modify this as we go along. But, you know, understand, here are our core beliefs in terms of security. I think that's probably worth their time. Microsoft, you know, Gates sent out that trustworthy computing memo 6 years ago or whatever it was. And that was sort of the cornerstone of what they've done since then. But they've changed that and modified it and done all kinds of different things since then. So, you know, I think it's still worth their time to get something on paper and get out in front of it a bit.
Well, that ends this edition of Security Squad. Be sure to check out our previous podcast by going to our podcast page at certsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest news and information at our news page at certsecurity.com/news. For Bill Brenner, Eric Parizeau, and Dennis Fisher, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.